everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sail, and in this week's show, we'll hear some short stories prompted by the word nourish.
I had rice, my first poppadom. God, it was good.
Suddenly, thousands of bees exploded from the branch and blackened the sky.
Flames licked from braziers of smouldering ashes. Red glowing coals fashioned necklaces of irresistible attractions.
I can't see them, but I know they're there, keeping me steady and secure, gently helping me take root, nourishing me.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and it's that time of year again. It's Book Week Scotland. Today, we'll hear a selection of short stories from this year's free book. And in a change this year, most of the stories are told by their authors, including hairy biker Dave Myers and chef and author Mary Contini. We'll hear how you can download your copy of the audiobook or the ebook version later on in today's show.
But first of all, let's hear from the people behind Book Week Scotland, the Scottish Book Trust.
Hi, I'm Philippa Cochran. I'm Head of Reader Development at Scottish Book Trust. We are a national organisation, and we all passionately believe that reading and writing and books and the pleasure of getting involved in all that and having it in your everyday personal life is of huge benefit to people across the country. So we exist to encourage, support and inspire people to read and write more.
So first of all, how do you encourage people to read more?
A variety of ways. We work with a whole range of different audience groups across the country. So we provide the Book Bug scheme for early years, new families with young children, where we gift books into the home. We also provide a schools programme that does touring and children's book awards and live events with the BBC to get kids excited about books and bring them into contact with authors and to encourage them to talk about books with one another. And we run a writer development programme, which is about encouraging writers to take their writing further, whether they're just starting out or whether they're quite committed professionals. And then we also run a number of schemes that anyone can get involved in, aimed more at sort of the general adult public. We run an annual campaign where people can tell us their stories around a particular theme. We run Book Week Scotland, which is the annual national celebration of reading that takes place in November. And we also work very closely with libraries and provide things like readers in residence to libraries around the country to support them to go out and engage with people in their communities.
And of course, you are the driving force behind the reason you're here. You've mentioned it before, but tell us more about Book Week Scotland.
Book Week Scotland, the straightforward answer is exactly what it says it is. It's a national celebration of reading and books and words and stories and the joy that we all get from them and reading for ourselves and sharing them. That happens in November. And for the entirety of that week, all around the country, there are events happening in every local authority. So we work very closely with the libraries. The libraries are a really central part of Book Week Scotland. Mm. And they deliver events through the library services in every local authority. But we also work with a whole range of other partners so they might be arts organisations, they might be community groups, they might be businesses, they might be schools. And they all get involved in the celebration in one way or another. There's things for all ages. There's things for all sort of reading interests. It's very much we are encouraging people to be sociable about their reading and the books that they enjoy. So encouraging people to talk about things that they enjoy, swap books with one another, maybe try something new. All sorts of things going on.
At a past RNIB event, Liz Lockhead, the former Macca, or National Poet of Scotland, had one of her poems transcribed into Braille. To prove to her that it was her poem, it was read out loud to her by a blind braille user, 8.5-year-old Mohammed.
My little sister likes to try my shoes.
Yeah.
Oh, but wobbles on their high heels.
High heels. Have you ever tried high heels?
I've tried my mum's on.
Yeah, I bet you. Yeah, everybody tries on big pe- this is what the girl in the poem's doing. Anyway.
They're
wobbles on their high heels
They're hard to bulk.
To balance. Is that true? When you wear your mummy's high heels? Yeah.
Yeah.
You're wobbling about?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I like to watch my little sister and I should not like to see her. In my shoes.
I should not like to see her in my shoes.
I wish she could stay. She could stay sensibly shod.
Yeah, sure-footed and sensibly shod. Wow. Well, I'll read it to you.
Fabulous.
So, you have proved to us that it works. Before that, I was listening to them, but I didn't know whether to believe them or not, really. But I guess it actually says everything that I thought it says. Will I read you the poem?
Yeah.
Okay. So, it's called Poem for My Sister, and I wrote it for my sister Janice when she was 12, for her 12th birthday. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give it to her in Braille next week on her 55th birthday. So she'll be quite chuffed to see that it's written in Braille. Yeah. And I think it looks very beautiful, so I'm going to put it on my wall as well. I love Braille. I think it's lovely. Although I don't think my fingers are sensitive enough. But I'm going to read you the poem. This is Poem for My Sister.
Yeah.
And my name is Liz Lockhead, so it's by me. Okay. My little sister likes to try my shoes, to strut in them. Admire her spindle-thin 12-year-old legs in this season's styles. She says they fit her perfectly, but wobbles on their high heels. They're hard to balance. I like to watch my little sister playing hopscotch. Admire the neat hops and skips of her. Their quick peck, never missing their mark, not overstepping the line. She is competent at peaver. I try to warn my little sister about unsuitable shoes, point out my own distorted feet, the calluses, odd patches of hard skin. I should not like to see her in my shoes. I wish she could stay sure-footed, sensibly shod. Thank you very much. What a big thrill it was hearing it in Braille. What age are you?
I'm 8.5.
You're just 8.5?
Yeah.
I thought you'd be 9 or 10.
Former Scots macker Liz Lockhead, and of course Mohammed, at a past RNIB Book Week Scotland event.
This year's free book for Book Week Scotland is called Nourish. That's the guideline, but the subject matter may be the comfort of favourite foods, the often repeated stories of memorable meals, new flavours discovered in far-flung destinations, or the support and love offered at the kitchen table. And so the people of Scotland share what the word nourish means to them. Rescuing chickens, unusual hangover cures, fish and chips by the sea, and the soothing power of porridge. These pieces offer a taste of people's lives, which are by turns funny, honest, moving, and heartbreaking. And the collection is the perfect recipe for a nourishing read. They're grouped under the six headings: family, childhood, a taste of Scotland, travel, self-discovery, and community. The stories were selected from hundreds that were sent to the Scottish Book Trust. And this year, working with RNIB, most of the stories were read by the authors themselves, either recorded at home or at the RNIB Talking Books Studios in Glasgow. And one person who recorded his own story is certainly someone who knows all about nourishment, one half of the Hairy Bikers, Dave Myers. Here he is reading his story from the childhood section, simply called Nourish.
To nourish means to care for and love, and the way I was brought up is to show this with food. I remember my mother's fish cakes, oh how I loved them. She would make them from hake steaks bought from Mrs. Hartley, the fishmongers at the bottom of Rysdale Road Barrow in Furness. Oh, they were good. She would poach the hake in milk with salt, white pepper and a couple of dried bay leaves. The fish would be flaked and mixed with an equal amount of cold, buttery, mashed potato. Then she would roll them in flour, dip in egg and encase in vivid orange breadcrumbs, you know, the type they could practically see from the moon. She would fry them till they were just perfect. With the poaching liquor, she would make a rich cheddar cheese sauce. Incidentally, also the colour of an orange high-visibility jacket. This was nourishment for the soul. This was my northern soul food. These became known as Mam's Killer Fish Cakes, as one morning they nearly killed me. I sat on the floor playing with my clockwork monkey as she cooked. The sense of anticipation was amazing. The smell wafted into my infant nostrils from the kitchen, and I sucked the wing-nut-shaped key that belonged to my clockwork toy. All of a sudden, I gulped, and the key was gone. Except not far enough, as it lodged in my throat. I ran to my mother, hoping that this wasn't going to interfere with my fish cakes. She screamed as I gasped for breath and rushed me to the local chemist, Mr. Gibson. You see, he had a car, and he sped me to North Lonsdale Hospital. I had an operation, and the key was surgically removed. Every cloud has a foodie silver lining, though, as in the 2 days I was on the wards, I got treated to unlimited quantities of ice cream, the same as the throaty kids who had just had their tonsils out. In one way or another, life's been the same for the last 60 years. Nah, I don't mean in hospital, but my relationship with food. It's been a hobby, a need and an obsession, and learning to cook is literally a way of feeding this need. I remember my first curry. When I came down to London in a flock wallpapered emporium in Broccoli, it was a mysterious, exotic world. I ordered Madras, only because I remember seeing a tin of Via Schwami's Madras curry powder rusting at the back of the shelf at home. I had rice and my first poppadom. God, it was good. And I vowed to return until I'd tasted everything on the menu. That I did, and I went home with an overdraft, or as I called it, a curry draft. The years rolled on, and I've been lucky enough to make my passion my profession, along with my best friend as one half of the Hairy Bikers. The whole experience has been nourishing and allowed to grow in love and friendship, though sometimes a little bit too much, because we had to go on a radical diet, as we both had become, shall we say, a little bit overnourished. Okay, well, fat. To the extent that we cast a shadow like two walnut whips. Last year, I had a moment that gave me the same emotions that my mother's fish cakes used to give me. Si and I were filming outside of Lyon with Georges Blanc. He has 3 Michelin stars, and his great-grandmother first opened the restaurant in the 19th century. Georges cooked as his grandmother's chicken recipe, a poulie de Bresse with morel mushrooms. I got to chop onions and help. The sense of anticipation was huge. Georges' son Frederick was there, and we 4 chaps were just a little bit giddy with excitement. The meal was wonderful. All that love, history and care. This is the very stuff of life. It nourished the soul, heart, mind and belly. 2 weeks later, I went back with my wife to share in Georges' kitchen. And she got to have that moment too. But you know, she's Romanian, and she feels the same way when we go back to Romania, where in the far north of Transylvania, we eat her mother's sarmale, cabbage leaves stuffed with rice, meat and spices. But there is more to food like this. To sum it up, from Michelin star to mum, there is love and there is no better nourishment than that.
Hairy Biker Dave Myers reading his story, Nourish. This edition of Read On is celebrating Book Week Scotland and we'll have more nourishing short stories in a minute. You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
I'm Katrina Armstrong. I'm the Head of Writer Development here at Scottish Book Trust, and my job involves mainly looking after writers. We look after writers of all ages and at various different stages at Scottish Book Trust. We run mentoring, training, we provide advice and resources. We run an award scheme for young writers, we run another award scheme for new writers, we provide mentoring for established writers. We run labs for writers who want to try working in a different medium. And we're just here over the phone or by email if you have any specific questions about writing or your writing career. And we've also got all sorts of great things online for people to participate in, either finding out more about how they can sort of pursue a career or just get involved in a fun way through our 50-word fiction competition. We also even have an online agony aunt. So there's lots of different things. And again, hopefully there's something for writers at any stage of their career or of all ages.
RNIB have a writing competition. If someone listening has entered that and wants to further their writing career, what can they do?
Well, there's lots of things they can do. They can have a look at our website where we have lots of information and advice and can also signpost other organisations. But I think probably our biggest programmes, our projects rather, is our New Writers Awards, where we take talented writers from across Scotland and we work with them intensively over a year. We provide them with a bursary of £2,000 so that they can free up some time. They get to go to Cove Park to spend time working on their writing. Cove Park is an artist's residency programme. We also provide them with PR and presentation training and mentoring, and there's all sorts of things. I mean, really, the purpose of the New Writers Awards is that we can't give intensive support to every single talented writer in Scotland. So what we do is we open our doors up and we take on sort of between 10 and 12 writers each year, and we work with them. And once we've got them, we never really let them go. So, and that's the New Writers Awards. And we would strongly encourage as many people as possible to apply.
Katrina Armstrong from the Scottish Book Trust, the people behind Book Week Scotland. And we'll hear more about them later on in today's show. This is a special edition of Read On, featuring stories from the free Book Week Scotland book, Nourish. Working with RNIB, the audiobook this year is read in the main part by the members of the public who wrote the stories. And our next one, under the heading of Self-Discovery, may have been recorded on location. It's Foodie Tips, courtesy of Yuri Gagarin, by Sherry Morris, and read by the author.
I remember the day I got my plot at the local community garden. I felt a mixture of fear and excitement. Fear, because I wasn't sure I could grow anything. Excitement, because if I could grow something, anything, be it potatoes, spinach, peas, broad beans, it'd be very satisfying to eat the food I'd grown. I knew there was something else in this mixture, something deeper. I couldn't name it then, but I could feel it. I'd already been working at the site 6 months. The land had previously been used as a dumping ground, but with council permission and money, it was now a new green space with individual plots for members. The first task was to clear the land and prepare the soil. I spent months of Saturdays alongside other volunteers removing utensils, plastic bags, old clothes, and broken bottles from the ground. One day I dug out a telephone. I thought of all the buried conversations and wondered what became of them. We cleared the space, removed the contaminated soil, added new. The new soil would enrich the ground. We'd also compost, and by nourishing the earth, it would nourish us in return. At least that's what I thought would happen. I was given a prime plot against the back wall. It was sheltered from the wind and received sun most of the day. I was now ready for the growing to begin. I started by digging. I used a pitchfork and shovel to turn the soil over and over again, marveling at its blackness, its richness. Then I studied the weather. Then I wondered what to plant. Because for all my eagerness and ready-to-go-ness, I realized I was afraid of starting. The truth was, I didn't know how to start, which was kind of funny, because I excelled at starting things. All my life I'd started things. Living in 5 different countries, 15 different cities, and 2 continents made me good at starting things. Even in this city, I'd moved 8 times in as many years. Settling didn't come easy. I didn't seem to be able to put down roots. I kept turning the soil, watching it move and shift. How could I possibly know what to plant? What would successfully take root? But I had to do something. Anyone who neglected their plot couldn't keep it. So I brought an old bookcase and propped it up against the wall. I put pots, seedling trays, and bags of potting soil on its shelves. I brought a large, bright pink tub, filled it with soil, and set it next to the bookcase. There, potatoes could grow. Then I brought a disco ball. The glitter and shine would keep the squirrels and birds at bay, so tender shoots and berries could mature. I surveyed my plot. It looked pretty good, though I'd have to do something about all that naked soil. I doubted I could get away with saying brown was the new green. Maybe a bird feeder would help, and I set off for the local nursery. I came back with a lavender bush, raspberry canes, a bay tree, strawberry plants, marigolds, and some purple calendulas. A good start. I invited my friend Russell, an experienced gardener, to have a look. He surveyed the space. "You have the strangest things growing on your plot," he said, and uncovered a Philip Stark lemon squeezer I was using to support raspberry canes. I asked him if he had any advice for me. "Well," he said, "your disco ball looks healthy, but I'd keep an eye on that bookcase. Might be prone to woodworm." I understood what he was saying. I didn't know why I was reluctant to begin planting, to get growing, or why I felt indifferent to what I had just put in. I decided I was restless. I'd been spending too much time at the allotment. I needed a break and went to a nearby park. There, I discovered a statue of Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, marking his visit to the UK in 1961. I didn't know much about the cosmonaut, but I knew Russian cuisine. Borscht, rye bread, boiled potatoes, stuffed cabbage rolls, beetroot salad, garlic cloves, and nearly every dish covered in sour cream or mayonnaise. Heavy food for a man whose mission was to fly through space amongst the stars. Funny he could consume all that heaviness and still fly. Then something occurred to me. Maybe it was possible to fly and flit about, yet remain connected. It didn't have to be one or the other. I thought about how I'd moved around so much, I didn't know how to put down roots. And now I was scared to. But I was getting older and tired, worn down. I needed to settle. I needed to connect. Looking at that statue, a seed was planted. This plot could keep me in one place, but I could still go off and come back. Looking after it, I could recharge, take nourishment from my surroundings, develop ties, establish roots. I didn't need to fear I was giving something up. Instead, I'd be gaining something. my very own space. I smiled. Now I knew how to get started. So this is what I grow on my plot. Beetroot, potatoes, radishes, carrots, onions, parsnips, garlic. Other things too, like berries and flowers and herbs, but the majority are root vegetables. I can't see them, but I know they're there, keeping me steady and secure, gently helping me take root, nourishing me. When the vegetables are ready, I harvest and eat them. They're tasty and filling. They make me feel solid, grounded, but also lighter, happier, content. It's like being grounded while flying.
That was Foodie Tips, courtesy of Yuri Gagarin, written and read by Sherry Morris. And the very next quick tale from the travel section of the book is After the Gasboard, July 1974, by Greg Michelson, read by the author.
Bent in the back of the tiny car, we bowled along dusty back roads, tracing groves of olives, stands of almonds, all bound for glass jars in northern cupboards. At midday, sunshine smearing the chalky sky, the Cinquecento dropped us at the service station and drove off through camouflage fields. We'd hitchhiked together since Athens, sleeping in orchards, in squares, in gardens, on benches, on beaches, on ferry boat decks. I had little French, he had no English, but by now each knew when the other was hungry. Lugging our rucksacks, we crossed the forecourt, outstaring the chained dogs barking from boredom. The entrance to the crumbling terracotta restaurant was bedecked with flowers. In the main salon, accordion double bass guitar clarinet spun jaunty folk tunes. Small children gambolled between the long tables of well-scrubbed guests grazing on the wedding fare. On the high dais, flanked by his families old and new, the immense elder, oozing from his Sunday suit, held court over this koan of chaos. The head waiter, imperious, uptight in button-down waistcoat, waved us to a corner table. We sat and glanced at the menus. Neither of us spoke Italian, but we knew, the head waiter knew, everybody knew, but even less lira than the price of a plate of bread and oil. We shrugged at each other, as he'd taught me. C'est la vie, I said. That's life, he said, as I'd taught him. As we stood and made for the exit, the bride's father looked round, stared at us affronted, and gesticulated to the head waiter. Sour-faced, the head waiter returned us to our corner. Worried, we sat quietly. What had we done? Who had we offended? What unspoken rule had we transcended? Swathed in white muslin, haloed in aged lace, the young bride, smiling, descended the platform and glided towards our lonely table. In each hand, a steaming blue bowl loaded with pasta, loaded with ragu, loaded with parmesan.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On Air, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. And today is a special edition with selections from this year's Book Week Scotland free book, Nourish. Mary Contini is the best-selling author of numerous books about Italian life and cooking, including Dear Francesca and The Italian Sausage Bible. The story she wrote for Book Week Scotland is called All Roads Lead to China.
All Roads Lead to China by Mary Contini, read by the author.
Perched on a bench in a hazardous tuk-tuk tricycle, we hung on for dear life as a tiny, toothless grandmother pedalled her way through the traffic, swerving impudently between fancy limousines and screeching taxis. She dodged a red light, took a sharp left, and stopped abruptly at some traffic lights. Accepting her fare of 10 yuan, about a pound, She gave us an encouraging grin and sped off, abandoning us at the edge of a busy highway. With no idea at all where we were, we felt slightly vulnerable, to say the least. The ancient city of Xi'an, in the heart of central China, is extremely crowded and congested. Traditional temples and ramshackle buildings contest for space and light in the shadows of futuristic skyscrapers. Home of Qin, the first emperor of China, his terracotta army is one of the top tourist attractions. We were visiting Olivia, our 20-year-old daughter, who was on a study year in China. She had left Edinburgh months before, alone and terrified, leaving us, my husband and I, in the same predicament. It was wonderful to be together again. She had fallen in love with the country and its people, and amazingly was already conversing well in Mandarin. Not sure of our bearings, we headed uncertainly down a dimly lit street. Our misgivings were relieved somewhat by a tantalising aroma of meat roasting and the appetising fragrance of toasted cumin, sumac and chilli. Encouraged, we quickened our pace. Turning a corner, our fears evaporated. Stretching ahead of us was a long, narrow street of low-dwelling houses, emblazoned with vibrant bright lights, overhanging lanterns and street decorations. Lively music and the strong beat of drums created a celebratory atmosphere. In the distance, hovering above the skyline, a massive Chinese bell tower sparkled with gold, red and green lights like an oversized flying saucer. Lining the street were innumerable makeshift kitchens, each with family groups preparing mouth-watering, sizzling food. Flames licked from braziers of smouldering ashes. Red glowing coals fashioned necklaces of irresistible attractions. The air was thick with smoke, the street packed with families laughing and eating. This is it! Olivia was relieved and excited. This is it, the Muslim food street! Positioned at the end of the exotic Silk Route, merchants and travellers from Persia, Arabia and central China had settled in Xi'an over 1,000 years ago. Today, the population in this small enclave in the heart of the city are almost entirely descendant of those original Muslim settlers. In the labyrinths around their great mosque, they trade halal dishes made from the very recipes handed down through generations. As descendants of an Italian immigrant family in Scotland ourselves, we felt an immediate kindred spirit with these Muslims in their adopted land. We too prepare food in the tradition of our forebears and make a living sharing it with our customers. We were excited and ravenous. The extreme pleasure of street food is its immediacy. A smile, an exchange of a little money, gives instant access to anything that entices. We didn't hesitate. Bowls of warming soup thickened with torn bread and filled with slithers of sweet tendered lamb were delightful. From enormous metal fryers, sizzling pastries stuffed juicily with marinated meat and spiced with chili pickle were delectable. Could this be the original burger? Young men slapped and kneaded enormous pieces of soft dough, transforming them until glossy and smooth. Then, with two or three flips of the wrist and bangs on the table, they magically stretched them into thick noodles. Boiled in huge cauldrons of water, they dropped into a bowl of hot broth, spring onions and tender lamb. We felt we had arrived. Could this be where pasta originated? A stripped carcass of a lamb hung as if vultures had devoured every morsel of flesh, but even so we didn't hesitate to try the lamb skewers, which were arranged like rows of warriors, marinated in sumac and cumin and grilled to sublime deliciousness on an open fire. Two young boys, dressed in black uniform with caps perched on their jet-black hair, chanted in rhythm as they banged thick wooden mallets on a high pile of sesame seeds thrown onto a worn wooden table. With good-humoured effort, they transformed them into sesame snacks, sweet, crunchy and deliciously warm, as if just out of the oven. Another pulled a thick white coil of sugar attached to a hook on a pole, throwing it back and forth over the width of the street, twisting it and pulling it repeatedly. The result? Spicy ginger-flavoured sugar rock, just like Edinburgh rock made before our very eyes. Bicycles passed between the crowds laden with baskets of golden green apples and giant strawberries. A wizened bearded man roasted giant chestnuts, the aroma pervading the air. Sweet offerings abounded, toffee crab apples arranged on sticks, pink pomegranate juice freshly squeezed, or piping hot apple punch, tasty with cinnamon and cloves. Sweet glutinous rice cakes, flavoured with rose jam, tipped from charming terracotta bowls, release an exotic aroma. Standing out in the crowd as the only Caucasians, we were quietly stared at, smiled at, and treated like celebrities. People, innocently intrigued by strangers among them, asked to take our photos. They enjoyed our enthusiastic appetites and laughed as we relished their food, offering us tastes of anything we glanced at. We felt like emperors. They asked who we were and where we came from. The response was always enthusiastic. Ah, Sugelan, Sean Connery. We returned the next morning to visit the Great Mosque of Xi'an, the largest and oldest in China. Inside its ancient boundaries, the noise and clamour of the modern metropolis and the exuberance of the food street faded in a peaceful, welcoming oasis. The melodic call to prayer summoned the men and boys from the stalls of the previous night, who came in groups quietly and respectfully, taking their shoes off at the entrance. We watched from outside entranced. On ancient posts around the beautiful courtyard, instructions from the Quran were inscribed in Asian languages and English. The messages were of peace, fairness and harmony, and rang true to our own beliefs. Rather than the many differences we saw, we felt a lot in common with these gentle people. We had been welcomed, nourished and included. Feeling happy and content, we lingered, then greedily headed back to the Muslim food street for lunch. You can never get too much of a good thing after all.
From the travel section of this year's Book Week Scotland Book Nourish, that was Mary Contini reading her story, All Roads Lead to China. And we're moving on to the community section of the book for Something Sweet. A Taste of Liquid Gold by Ruth Anderson. Read by the author.
There she was, in the dark, sticky crevice between the wooden frames. She moved slowly, surrounded by her retinue, delicately cleaning and feeding her, while others stood guard, alert and attentive. I reached slowly into the gap, asking with my bare finger. She obliged, and I gently lifted her long, delicate body, revealing a regal beauty. The day was warm and the clouds still, so I knew she wouldn't get chilled. She seemed quite content resting on my finger, looking intently back at me with her dark orb eyes. There is something deeply spiritual about holding a queen honeybee. Here is a creature that can lay up to 2,000 eggs a day in the height of the season. Her abdomen vibrated on my finger, and I felt a tingling deep in my chest. I prepared for a heart-to-heart. "Hello, beauty," I said. "Thank you for keeping 40,000 bees happy. Thank you for creating thousands of workers, all females, of course. Oh, and then you lay hundreds of unfertilized eggs to produce those loud, hairy males." I paused, glancing at a passing drone. "Why do the boys make so much noise?" I smiled as she cocked her head and brought her front leg over to clean her antenna. "You are such an incredible creature. The female workers do a great job, but you are amazing, with your perpetual egg-laying ability and strong pheromones that keep the colony so content." She lifted her front leg, wiped her orb eyes, and then danced around my finger looking for her home. I gently placed her back on top of the Hoffman self-spacing wooden frames, waited until she crawled down the crevice into the waxy combs, and then closed the crown board. "Have a beautiful day," I said, replacing the roof firmly on the cedarwood hive. With the queen back in amongst the bees, I heard the colony's tone deepen to a contented hum and smiled. Looking at the entrance, I checked the foraging bees. Some had bellies full of nectar and struggled with their zeppelin-style landings, loaded with carbohydrates for energy. Some had hind legs full of pollen balls, securely packed into their corbiculae, otherwise known as the bee's knees. I counted 5 different colours of pollen, which meant that the developing larvae were enjoying a varied diet. I made a mental note to try some different protein sources and vary my own diet. With plenty of pollen coming in, there would be lots of young brood, and the queen would be laying well. Watching the hive entrance and observing the colony's behaviour is informative, but also meditative. The constant movement of bees arriving and departing is an intricate circulation system, coordinated by vibrations, touch, and pheromones. The heart valves are guard bees at the entrance, with forelegs raised and antennae alert. Workers regulate temperature both inside the hive and at the entrance. On a hot day, they are clearly visible, standing facing the hive and fanning their wings to produce an air conditioning system for temperature regulation and moisture reduction. Recently, a swarm arrived in the apiary, blackening the sky before finding a larch branch to hang from. Scout bees buzzed back and forth, looking for a suitable home. Finding an empty brood box, they rushed back to perform their waggle dance, up and down the surface of the clustered swarm. Suddenly, thousands of bees exploded from the branch and blackened the sky. For a few minutes, I was honoured to witness the incredible sight of a swarm murmuring. Soon they descended, following the pheromones of the scout bees intensely fanning their tail glands in the air at the hive entrance. The Nazanov gland, in between the last two tergites, has a scent that draws bees home like an old school bell calling children in from the playground. Soon I could see the sky again as the swarm descended into their new home. Thanks for the delicious honey, I called whilst loading the supers onto my van. I only take a little from each hive, leaving plenty for the bees to eat. For me, it is only right, as they have done all the hard work, foraging and processing nectar from millions of flowers. Spring honey from Ayrshire is like a fine wine. Its aroma is intoxicating and draws your nose to the jar. Once your tongue reaches that golden liquid, there is a strong, deep, and rich taste of malty honey, followed by a tangy, floral dandelion hit. And finally, the combination of dark, nutty sycamore nectar with a light, delicate almond finish from the hawthorn, otherwise known as the may. The creation of honey is an alchemistic process that we cannot replicate. Nectar collection is followed by the bees adding enzymes and reducing the water content until it's less than 20%. Finally, the honey is sealed with beeswax cappings. Each floral source has its own unique nectar that influences the taste of the honey. In addition, this nutritious liquid contains minute grains of pollen from all the flowers visited. Pollen is rich in protein, full of amino acids, and honey has anti-inflammatory properties, as well as being high in antioxidants. In the honey house, I start uncapping each frame with a long knife. The honey seeps out, and I quickly place each frame into the extractor. I watch the wagon wheel effect of the frames spinning backwards as thin strands of fresh liquid gold are forced to the inner walls of the extractor. A golden river flows down, pooling in the base, desperate to get out. I open the tap and a cascade of raw honey forces its way through the filter and down into the ripening tank. 2 days later, the honey house is filled with jars of liquid gold, labelled and ready to share.
RNIB Library has the largest library of its kind in Europe, with over 60,000 items in the collection. You choose the books, you choose the format, and we deliver to you. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999.
I'm Katrina Wallace. I'm the head of early years at Scottish Book Trust, and my job involves working with our youngest audience, right from birth up to age about five. We run the Book Bug programme, which is free packs of books for every child in Scotland at set stages to help support them and their families really enjoy stories, songs and rhymes right from the start.
So how do you engage readers before they go to school?
Well, we really believe that a love of stories can start right from when a child is born. We know that the parent's voice or the carer's voice is the most important thing to that child. And so even when a baby can't respond and talk back to you and tell you what they like about the story, they're still going to be getting a lot out of hearing that familiar voice, building a really strong relationship with the important adult in their life. And it's not just about books, it's also about songs and rhymes and laying those early, very, very early foundations that will later lead on to literacy, hopefully, and a love of reading. And we also have Book Bug sessions, which are free story, song and rhyme sessions for children between birth and five and their families. You can come along for free to your local library and join in with lots of fun. And if you go to one during Book Week Scotland, you'll get a special Book Week Scotland sticker as well.
So I'm in primary one. What do I get?
Well, you get an amazing pack of books of your very own. It comes in a little canvas bag with a handle that's the right size for a five-year-old.
So what happens after primary one?
After primary one, we hand over to our schools team, who then take children on a sort of a broader love of reading. We have a whole range of programmes that engage with children through school, things like our Authors Live programme. We have a touring programme to take well-known authors around Scotland to places where they might not normally reach. And we have a whole range of other resources available on our website to allow children to engage directly, but also to support teachers and learning professionals with encouraging just that love of reading. What we're really about is making sure that children have the opportunity to read what they want and that they're really encouraged to read for pleasure as well as what they'll be doing in school. And you can find out more at our website, which is www.scottishbooktrust.com.
Thanks to Katrina and everyone from the Scottish Book Trust. You can download the whole audiobook featuring 40 tales of Nourish from the Book Week Scotland website. It's completely free, so just search for Book Week Scotland and follow the links to Nourish. You can also download it as a free ebook. For now though, from the self-discovery section of the book, here's our last tale. Finger Food by Sam Elder Gates. Read by the author.
His final year, not the best time to switch teachers. And it looked as if he had little in common with the new appointment, an Italian pianist who sounded ancient. There were three of his recordings in the college library, all Beethoven, all on 78 RPM, and this was 1970. But instantly, Benedici, he used his surname only, came across as enthusiastic and friendly. During their first lesson together, he talked almost constantly, but occasionally his fingers would spin a shimmering melody or unleash a terrifying power. His students sat there transfixed. Here was a poet, a wizard, a demon. Then it occurred to him, this was the very man to teach him Beethoven's Appassionata. It would make an impressive centrepiece for his diploma recital. Could he study it? There was a pause, but the teacher smiled and agreed. He worked hard to get the huge, demanding sonata under his fingers, but became nervous about playing for such a formidable musician. His hands would tighten, and at one lesson he suddenly stopped playing. Unexpectedly, Benedici asked him if he had ever made bread. After an awkward silence, the teacher explained himself. In Scotland, I only see soft white bread with no forza, no strength. In the Appassionata, Beethoven demands everything, from the softest whisper to the wildest storm. You will need stamina. For this, I made my own pane integrale, bread with many seeds and grains. My friend, if you make your own bread, your fingers will become stronger and your Beethoven will sing. He found Benedici's advice strange and eccentric, but at home over the weekend his mother disagreed. When she was his age, the country was at war and the only bread available was a national loaf made from regulation flour with added vitamins to keep everyone nourished. No one in the house would eat it, so his granny invented her own version. His mother smiled as she recalled the ingredients. Flour, oats, yeast, salt, buttermilk, dried seeds from the garden. Next morning, looking for a cup of tea after practicing his scales, he noticed a collection of ingredients in the kitchen table. He tried to look interested as his mother measured and mixed them together, then formed, stretched and folded the mixture while singing along to family favourites on the wireless. Eventually, when the unappetising lump was covered and placed in a bowl on top of the warm stove, he escaped back to the piano. After lunch, he kicked under the cover. The dough had risen. It might make a loaf yet. His mother caught him, smiled, and sprinkled some flour on the table. Your turn, she said. This is called knocking back. Make two fists and bash its wee face in. Picking up the pale rubbery thing, he thumped, kneaded and pulled it till he was told it was time for it to rest and for him to go back to the piano. Later, he had another go at the dough till his mother decided it had finally proved. It was time to put it in the oven. He became absorbed in his piano practice again till the smell of fresh bread called him to the kitchen. And there it was, one plump golden loaf, a small miracle. When it had cooled, he was surprised by its strong, almost sour taste. But when he tried it with some butter, he began to savour its complex flavours. He was converted. Back in Glasgow with his mother's recipe, he asked his landlady where to find yeast and wholemeal flour, and when he explained why he needed them, she offered him the run of the kitchen while she was at work. He fell into a daily pattern of practicing, drinking tea and bashing out loaves. Then, in the grain store, he found himself drawn to ingredients with intriguing names. Molasses, linseeds, allspice, dulse. Soon, subtle new tastes and textures found their way into the bread, rolls and buns that he made and fed to the other students in the digs. He was improvising just as his granny had done. As his fingers and forearms became stronger, the tightness fell away from his hands and he was playing with no sign of nerves. He thanked Benedici for advice, but soon he had to admit another problem. The Appassionata. He could play the notes, but felt unable to put himself into the music, to feel involved. Benedici, of course, knew this already, and after one of his characteristic pauses, put forward an idea. Think of the piece as a loaf of bread. Beethoven's score is a wonderful recipe. But remember, you are the one who must create the shape, the texture, the colour of the music. When you perform, he added sotto voce, you are a master baker, a maestro. He thought about this. When he started baking, he had relied on his mother's recipe, but now was guided more by intuition and sense of touch. Every loaf he made was different. Should every musical performance be different too? Tentatively, he tried playing without the score, trusting his memory to guide him. Thinking carefully about the sound he was creating, he began slowly to savour Beethoven's deep, succulent melodies and sharp, bitter discords. Without the safety net of the printed music, his imagination began to soar. He soon discovered how to use that elusive, magical ingredient his playing had lacked, his personality. That final year passed quickly, punctuated by spiced Christmas cake, heart-shaped biscuits and hot cross buns. When the date for his diploma recital arrived, he knew whatever happened, he would soon leave college and say goodbye to Benedice, his wise and wonderful professore. But this was more of a beginning than an end. He thought of all the pianos he would play, the music he would discover, the new ideas, people and opportunities life would present. And already his mother had noticed a local baker was looking for an assistant. Just for the summer, of course.
And that was our final story for today, Finger Food, written and read by Sam Elder Gates.
Alas, that's all we've got time for in today's show. But if you want to hear more stories of Nourish, there's a free ebook or audiobook version available at either ScottishBookTrust.com, that's all one word, ScottishBookTrust.com, or just search for Book Week Scotland and follow the links to Nourish.
Now, there are a few days left of Book Week Scotland. Back over to Philippa Cochran.
It's Book Week Scotland. There's loads of events taking place all over the country, lots of different ways that you can take part via our website. The contact details you need at www.bookweekscotland.com. And if you do nothing else, go and visit your library or your local bookshop and just find a book that you love.
And if you want more from Read On Air, you can head to our Audio Boom page. All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews and exclusive author interviews. There's a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. So, until next week, farewell and remember to read on.